Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author of that book. This week's guest is biochemist Chris Cooper, head of research in sports and exercise science at the University of Essex. We are discussing his book, Run, Swim, Throw, Cheat: The Science Behind Drugs in Sport, published by Oxford University Press in 2012. Just this past August, the long and convoluted story of doping allegations against Lance Armstrong came to its presumed end. Armstrong gave up the fight against charges that he had engaged in doping while winning 7 straight Tour de France titles. While Armstrong continues to maintain his innocence, and many people still believe him, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency has stripped the cyclist of his titles and banned him from competitions. But whether or not Armstrong did in fact dope, the evidence and accusations surrounding his story confirms that cycling of the late 90s and early 2000s, like women's track and field of the 1980s or baseball of the 1990s, was inextricably tangled with performance-enhancing drugs. Of course, in these cases, the question is often asked, how do we view the athletes and accomplishments from these tainted periods of sports history? Do we strip the titles and erase the records, or let them stand under the assumption that, since nearly everybody was doing it, those athletes who won were simply the best of a dirty lot? Chris Cooper insists that before we make judgments about doping in sports, we need to understand how doping works in the blood and muscles of athletes. Are performance-enhancing drugs truly unsafe to the health of athletes? And do they give a measurable advantage, an unfair advantage, to competitors who are doping? Chris addresses these questions in his book and in our interview. If you're like me, you've surely read plenty of sports writers' accounts of doping scandals. But after reading Chris's book and chatting with him about it, I now have a clear understanding of the issues surrounding performance-enhancing drugs. Here is our interview. Our guest this week on New Books in Sports is Chris Cooper. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So by way of an introduction, I'll tell listeners that Chris is a biochemist who is a professor and head of research at the Center for Sports and Exercise Science at the University of Essex. And I'll ask you to start, Chris, by telling us what led you to bring these two interests together, biochemistry and sport.
Well, as I say, I've always been interested in sport, and I am a biochemist, and actually some of my research is now in the area of sport, not particularly about drugs, but I do work on an area where I try and create artificial blood for clinical reasons, to replace blood transfusions, and that's one area of a sort of molecule that's banned in sports. So I got a research interest indirectly in sports and in doping, but I also have a general interest. I mean, I teach a module, a course, to our undergraduate students at the university on drugs in sport. And some people say, well, why not just write a book and explore it properly as a sort of slightly naive biochemist going into the whole area of drugs in sport and saying, what's the research say? Where are things now? Where are they going to go in the future?
One thing I enjoyed about the book is that you're clearly enthusiastic about new discoveries in the field in sports science. So can you give us a sketch of how you've seen the field develop over the last decade or two decades or so?
I think it's starting to take on a much more modern way of looking at things. It's quite interesting. Sports science has traditionally been very sort of physiology and psychology based, I guess, in the US and Canada. It's sort of called kinesiology, but those sort of areas. And what's happening is a much more modern molecular techniques are coming into the sports science field, and that's really interesting. So I think, rather bizarrely, the biochemists were not looking at the whole body very often. They sort of forgot about the whole body. And the sports scientists sort of forgot about or didn't look at the individual molecules. And now those two expertises are coming together, and it's quite an exciting time, really, in that biochemists now are much more interested in the whole body, and sports scientists are much more interested in the individual molecules. So it's a much more synthetic, I mean, I think the concept is what's generally called systems biology, systems physiology, that's sort of come together at the moment, and it's quite an exciting time because of that.
And is this being driven by athletes and trainers then?
I think not particularly. I mean, driven by the scientists wanting to understand the basic science of what happens, and that requires using the most modern techniques. Mm-hmm. I think the trainers are much more focused on the immediate effect. So I think as a sports scientist, I usually have sometimes have a different time scale of thought to when I speak to athletes and coaches. I mean, I don't do too much work with coaches, but when I do, they want to know immediately what works now, how it helped me get to the next level. And as a scientist, I tend to be looking at a much more longer frame. So I have to have two mindsets, really.
So let's turn to the book, and you begin the book with an episode that happened in 1988, and that was the infamous final of the men's 100-meter sprint at the Seoul Olympics. So could you talk about that race and how it was perhaps representative of athletics at the time?
Yeah, well, I think not just at that time. I mean, in that particular race, I guess the sort of view is that Ben Johnson won in this super fast time. For those of you who don't remember, 9.73, the fastest time by a long way ever, and he was celebrating before he crossed the line, and that was an amazing event, and certainly an amazing event for Canada because he was a Canadian. But I guess the next morning, the world woke up to know the name Ben Johnson. And because 100-meter sprint is like the blue ribbon event of the games. And then 3 days later, they woke up to know about the anabolic steroids because he was tested positive for anabolic steroids and therefore had his gold medal taken away. Then there was a big inquiry in Canada into that. And subsequently, when you look at the athletes who competed in that event, very many of them were tainted by accusations or in some cases shown to have been taking performance-enhancing drugs, in particular anabolic steroids, to increase their power of sprinting. So it was sort of a seminal event in drugs in sport because it was the men's 100 metres in the Olympic final, and it was won so fast. And although steroids have been around for a long time and probably performance-enhancing drugs were fairly common from the late 70s onwards, certainly in the 80s, that was the moment when the world grew up to know it.
So I'll follow up on that and ask about the history of drugs and sports and what led us to that race in 1988. When and where did doping begin, and why did it become so widespread?
Well, it really depends what you mean by drugs and doping, because arguably you'd go back in terms of the gladiators. Mm-hmm. They were taking, you know, certain herbs or things that they thought would help them improve their performance. And if you can go back to Pliny talking about various compounds and herb extracts. So the idea of using special chemicals to enhance performance is certainly not new. In terms of trying to get drugs to improve performance, even in the early 20th century, people were using compounds. So there's the famous, I think it's Olympics 1912, when the marathon, the first person to pass the line in the marathon actually cheated because he drove a car halfway around, or was driven in a car, but the one who actually won had taken strychnine and alcohol, so these sort of stimulants. But that was perfectly legal. But that, even at that point, people were taking compounds to enhance performance. And it sort of rumbled on. I mean, in the 1930s, amphetamine started to get used, and certainly in football matches in Britain, they were being used in some World Cup final and some Football Association Cup finals. And then also compounds like, well, really, testosterone, the precursors of anabolic steroids. People were taking what they called monkey glands or monkey juice, which really was sort of extracts of monkey scrotum, I suppose, to get the testosterone, which is the male sex hormone, which you get from those glands. And I think even the Marx Brothers sang about monkey glands. So it was around in the 30s. Sigmund Freud was the first one to use cocaine to try and improve performance. So he was actually one of the first sports scientists. Sigmund Freud did really nice interesting studies on the effect of cocaine on hand grip strength. But like the normal, sort of normal in the inverted commas, recreational drugs, it sort of rumbled along in the 20th century with mild disapproval, concern, is it okay or not? The Second World War saw everyone using amphetamines, and it was defined to keep awake in during the battles, etc. And it really was in the 60s that they began to be seen, I think, as being an outright evil. And whether that's a parallel with what was happening with recreational drugs and sports drugs, I don't know. But that's about when steroids came out and being thought of as being problematic, the 60s and 70s. So then it became a big issue. It's arguable who started using steroids, which are the anabolic steroids that increase your power, the compounds that we're talking about, Ben Johnson. But probably it was some Eastern European or Russian weightlifters and or US bodybuilders were the first. But along those lines, that it became more common and widespread.
So looking then at the post-war period, when anabolic steroids come to be used by bodybuilders, by athletes in the Soviet bloc, who was developing these performance-enhancing drugs? Was this something that pharmaceutical chemists were setting out to do, to create drugs that would make people stronger and faster?
Well, steroids really evolved. Well, evolved. They were discovered, if you like, though they are natural molecules. You discover them rather than create them. In the 1930s, there was a big interest by pharmaceutical companies and by researchers in the US and in Switzerland and Germany, to Belgium as well, to get these molecules. I mean, the first testosterone, to try to get the testosterone, there was one US scientist who was just using the cadavers from the Chicago stockyards, a big source of animals, and still is, I think. But certainly in that time, that was the big place where all the animals were killed with agriculture in the US. And somebody in Switzerland was just taking, you know, hundreds of liters of urine from Swiss policemen to purify the molecule. So they were doing this mass industrial scale purification to see what this special molecule was that was the male sex hormone. Once they discovered it, there was a big interest by pharmaceutical companies because they thought this would be wonderful molecules. They would give you long life and strength and vitality. So there was a huge interest in it for life-enhancing properties. And it's sort of unfortunate that it hasn't really lived up to that hype. I mean, it's a similar hype about human growth hormone at the moment, which, again, hasn't really lived up to it. So it was discovered and developed because they thought it would be good for human health and medicine, not for sport. Turns out it's probably, apart from a few clinical cases, it's most effective in that area, in the sports, in increasing power.
So let's turn to the science behind these drugs, behind steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs. And you start the book by laying out the chemical processes that occur when the body exercises. And we don't have the opportunity to go through all that in the interview, but instead I'll ask you something that's a more pointed and selfish question related to that. What would be your suggestion as a biochemist for the optimal exercise program for, say, a male academic in his mid-40s? What is going to be the best activity in terms of working his internal chemistry?
In terms of health or in terms of... In general
good. Yeah, general health.
So general health, I mean, it gets quite boring in a sense. General health, I wouldn't almost say exercise. Any physical activity is good. And when you look at the graphs of, you know, cardiovascular risk, which is mostly the benefit of exercises in cardiovascular health, you know, reducing heart attacks, any exercise you do, the more you do, is better. So if you look at it, so and almost not exercise, so any activity, and the graph gets steepest at the beginning. So if you do no exercise and you're a 40-year-old academic, do some. If that just means walking from the car to the, you know, a bit further or walking up the stairs, do it. You'll see a benefit. You don't need to do, if you're just thinking about the general health benefit, you don't need to do much. You need to do anything. But if you do more, it'll be better. The big debate at the moment in the sports science field is about... can you get away with doing very little exercise but very high intensity? Mm-hmm. And that's really been the argument in the last 10 years. So there's a group, and it's a number of people that have shown that you can get good fitness by doing essentially 3 minutes exercise a week. The problem is the 3 minutes of exercise is absolutely horrible to do. So you do maximum intensity exercise for, you know, a minute, and then you do that. It's basically 3 20-second exercises. And when we do that exercise in the lab, sometimes the students throw up. So, I mean, it's a level of high intensity. But that's the debate at the moment, is can you get away with very high intensity for short periods of time, or do you need to do this a very long period of time? You know, sort of behind the 30 minutes, three times a week, which is sort of what they've been recommending. But what I should say, and I really want to say this quite clearly, is that if you just want to get reduce your risk of heart attacks and stroke, you just need to do more exercise than you're currently doing, almost certainly. And you don't need to, you know, be obsessive about it. Just do more. So that's the sort of crude health message. If you've got a specific event to do that you want to train for, then, of course, it's a rather more specific exercise program you would need to undertake.
Well, let's turn to illegal and unsafe performance boosters. And I want to start first by asking about EPO and blood doping. And in my reading about this in the past, about blood doping, I had been under the impression that the purpose of blood doping, so for instance with long-distance cyclists, was for them to get more oxygen in their blood. But I gather that's not entirely correct, is it?
No, it's pretty much correct. I think that reading is correct. It turns out that how fast you can perform in an aerobic sport, like long-distance cycling, like long-distance running, is very controlled by the physical amount of oxygen you can dissolve in your blood. And that's controlled by and large by how much of the hemoglobin, the red protein, that carries the oxygen around the blood you can have. So anything that increases that would increase the oxygen content in your blood and therefore should improve performance. So no, I think that's pretty right, pretty correct. That's why athletes do altitude training, or they train in these low oxygen tents to try and increase the number of red blood cells, the number of amount of hemoglobin molecules, the amount of oxygen they can carry.
Okay. So then my confusion as a historian with a less than layman's understanding of chemistry was that altitude training and connected with that blood doping was aimed perhaps at not at putting more oxygen into the blood, but getting the blood or getting the athlete to perform on less oxygen in the blood.
No, because in fact they don't, one of the problems with altitude training has historically been that you can't train as hard at altitude.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, and therefore it's not that you get used to training with low amount of oxygen, therefore you're better when you sprint. No, it's a genuine, the body's response to low oxygen is to increase the number of red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to a lower level, you've got more red blood cells, so you can perform better. So it's not that you stress the body and do the exercise at altitude. In fact, what athletes do now is they go to altitude to sleep there and live there and come down to ground level to do their training. It's called live high, train low. So they deliberately avoid what you're saying. They don't want to do the training at altitude because they can't train at the right intensity, and they detrain themselves. So they train on the ground, sea level, and go up to altitude to live.
And so then does doping mimic that?
So doping does mimic that in a nutshell. So the body's response to altitude or to a situation where it has low oxygen, a number of things get triggered. But in the long term, the trigger is make more red blood cells. And the molecule that does that, there's a number of them, but on that pathway, is a molecule called EPO or erythropoietin. So the body, in response to low oxygen, which you get at high altitude, is the kidney releases the hormone EPO. And EPO then triggers an increase in red blood cells. You can get around that, therefore, not bother with the altitude, by just injecting EPO. So EPO is a shortcut to do that. And because it's a shortcut, it actually turns out you could probably get to a higher number of red blood cells because you can get more EPO by injecting it than you can by going to altitude. So it's not the shortcut. But it actually probably gets you to a higher level. And the other thing you can do is just do a straight blood transfusion, which immediately gets you more red blood cells. And that's the quickest way to be able to run faster.
And does this work then?
Yes. I mean, the surprising thing is that in sports doping, it's all basically parasitizes around medicine. So even the steroids we talked about were originally supposed to be medical drugs, got taken up by sports doping. And there's a sort of might be surprising why anything works, because medicine usually takes things that don't work and tries to make them normal. And what sports people want to do is take normal and make them supernormal. There's no guarantee that something that takes someone who's deficient to a normal level will also get them to a supernormal level. But it turns out that seems to be the case with red blood cells. So if you have somebody, obviously, who's an accident, loses blood, you give them a blood transfusion to bring them back to the normal level. If you take a normal person and you give them more blood, that appears to give you even more oxygen and you perform even better. And what people thought was the case was maybe the blood would get too thick and therefore it wouldn't flow as well because of too many red blood cells. And that would counteract that effect. Actually, that doesn't seem to be the case. Pretty much you can go, you can increase the red blood cells to levels above what you can get naturally and you increase performance. So that's been a big issue and a big problem in the sports doping industry, but you know, it pretty much does work. I mean, if I had to be hand on heart to say what were the two of all the many things that athletes use to improve performance, banned or non-banned, the two things that really work would be anabolic steroids for female athletes, mm-hmm. giving them male sex hormones, getting the muscular works, and blood doping with any endurance athletes. They're the things that I would say the best scientific evidence that they work. Everything else is a little bit anecdotal and circumstantial.
So as you said, blood doping is effective for endurance athletes, and you've already mentioned anabolic steroids. So I want to turn to that. And before we do talk about steroids, something interesting I found in the book is that you write that while sports scientists know a lot about blood and oxygen and how they work in athletics, they don't know as much about the internal chemistry of muscles during exercise. Why is that the case?
It's a good question, because I was really surprised, because sometimes you leave fields of science that you don't know about and you come back to them and think, why haven't they solved that problem? I assumed that it would be really well known exactly how testosterone worked to increase muscle mass. I think when I was an undergraduate student, I'd learned about how sex hormones work. So you know the basic thing about how steroid hormones or sex hormones work, and they bind to a receptor that go inside the cell. But actually, the individual parts of DNA, which is ultimately where these molecules interact with, which cause you to trigger the pathways to increase muscle protein synthesis and therefore to increase muscle mass, that pathway is not well characterized in the muscle. So we know quite a bit about how testosterone causes secondary sexual effects that we have. We know quite a lot about it in prostate cancer because enhanced testosterone levels causes problems in prostate cancer. But in the muscle, I would say we don't know the fine molecular details of how testosterone works. Now, there's not an awful lot of research going on in that area because the research is usually driven by medical need. And it's unfortunate that steroids have not proved to be this wonderful medical panacea that was hoped in the 1930s and 1940s. So there's not a huge amount of research because it looks like the area is not going to be productive for new molecules, but also the number of diseases that cause problems with muscle mass is few. I mean, they're not minor. I mean, things like muscular dystrophy, but it's not like cancer, it's not like heart disease, it's not like Alzheimer's, it's smaller. And therefore, there's less research money goes in. So less research money means less discovery. So I think that would be my view. I mean, there's not a lot of money in sport. You might think there is, but actually in thought, in terms of the science bit, there's not a lot of money. And compared to medicine, even sport compared to medicine is a small industry. So that's probably why the development has not been as rapid as we might have thought. Or it's just complicated, and we're not clever enough to find it out. I mean, you know, it might just be we haven't done the right experiments yet. But I think that's potentially what's happening, which means there are unexplored fields for dopers to sort of tag onto. But I think what I've said perhaps before is that they tend not to do that because that's expensive and difficult. They tend to parasitize on drugs that scientists have found for something else. So although in the book I talk about certain pathways that you might want to think about doing if you wanted to improve performance, I don't think there's any chance that, you know, dopers would do that. They'll just wait for medicine to do something similar and then copy it. And that would be the concern.
Well, following up on that, so you mentioned the dopers who are developing these drugs. Who are these people? Who's making EPO and anabolic steroids? Are they, and are these chemicals easy to make? Are they difficult to make?
relatively easy to make. I mean, it depends what level we're talking about. So EPO is just made, I mean, it's a normal compound, and it has a very strong, important clinical use in treating lack of red blood cells in kidney disease. So if you have a kidney problem, you have less red blood cells because you're not making EPO. They're treated with EPO. So there's a big black market in EPO. And it's relatively easy to make it now by modern techniques. It used to be that these drugs were hard to make because you need to purify them from dead bodies. But EPO you make in by genetic techniques now in bacteria or in cultured cells. And that's fairly easy. And it's off patent, so there's generic companies making it. So EPO is has a potential, you know, on the black market. You can get it. Same with human growth hormone, another hormone like that you can access. Anabolic steroids. I'm not an expert. I'm a biochemist, not a journalist. I don't know where all the routes for black market drugs are. Anabolic steroids can be made relatively simply in laboratories. So it's probably with steroids a mixture of the black market, because they do have some clinical use, and home labs, I think places in the US and Mexico, probably other places in the world. Some countries you can buy steroids over the counter because you can buy medicines over the counter, so they can ship that way. So I think it's a combination of things. I say I'm not an expert because I I know I'm not into the drug trade, but it's not that difficult. What's more difficult is to make a new compound. So or to access a compound that's in clinical trials that's not in the market. So there's quite often new varieties of EPO that are being made because EPO, you want to modify the drug to make it better, last longer, or have less side effects. And when those are in clinical trials, they might be harder to get hold of before they get into the commercial market. So, but a lot of the interest is not in just getting the molecules, but to get ones that can't be tested for. And the classic example of that was the Balco Laboratories and the US chemist who developed a molecule called the Clear, which is what Marion Jones took and Tim Montgomery, and in the UK, Dwayne Chambers, which was specifically designed such that an engineer in the lab such that it couldn't be detected by anti-doping agencies. And that, I think, I could see that carrying on being happening because that's an idea that it's not too difficult to think of how you might do that. You're not trying to think of a whole new field of research. You're saying, how can I make this molecule less easy to detect? And that is a possibility.
But to do that, the dopers would need a good amount of resources to do that kind of development. And as you were just saying, there isn't that much money.
Well, Patrick Johnson, who developed that was not, it was pretty much in the same sort of labs that make recreational drugs in the US. Not that difficult.
Okay.
So, but of course, he'd not have any expensive pharmaceutical companies in doing clinical trials. So if you develop a new drug for a medicine, you have to spend, tens of millions of pounds going through regulation. And they just put it straight into people, which I think is actually pretty scandalous, really. So it's possible their modifications could have been really bad, but they just did them anyway. So in that sense, it's cheaper because you're not doing any of the regulation and any of the safety tests in animals. You're just putting it straight to people. So it's a little bit cheaper. The chemistry's not that difficult. I think for versions of EPO might be a bit more complicated, but I think much more likely is to find molecules that drug companies use and then copy them. And I think that is still possible. There are compounds on the EPO pathway, but not EPO, that I think might be of interest to dopers. And so there's a great interest in the anti-doping agencies talking to the pharmaceutical companies and say, okay, you've got a new molecule. It's going to get out to the dopers. They'll either make it themselves or they'll nick it, steal it, give it to us, and we want to test for it. And they develop tests during the preclinical testing, during the animal testing, to make sure that when it gets into the athletes, they've got a test ready for it. And that's, I think, a much more, if you like, aggressive anti-doping activity to really make sure they know what's available and they can test for it.
I want to go back to anabolic steroids and back to the story that starts your book. You had mentioned that anabolic steroids with women provide a clear jump in performance, but thinking of Ben Johnson and his world record, was that the result of steroids, would you say?
I think it's difficult to judge on individuals. I think Johnson probably ran faster because he was on steroids, yes. I mean, I think you'd be very careful, because I refuse to go down the line of saying is when you see a fast time, mm-hmm. that person must have been on steroids. But, I mean, my biggest time at the Olympics that I was on go on radio and TV was when a Chinese swimmer did a very fast time, and a US coach said, that must be doping. And, me and most of the athletes were saying, you can't do that, otherwise everyone gets accused of doping. So I'm very careful of not saying a fast time means you must be doping. Clearly, Ben Johnson thought it was improving his speed and power, and there's reasonable good evidence that steroids can have that effect. So it wouldn't surprise me if Ben Johnson, for him, the steroids made him go faster. Yes. So in that sense, I think it's certainly a possibility. There's also a big placebo effect. If you're on steroids, you know you're on steroids, you go a lot faster. I mean, it's not clear that Tim Montgomery or Dwayne Chambers were faster because they were on steroids. I mean, Dwayne Chambers is the UK athlete. Wasn't a huge lot faster when he was on steroids, and that was only for a couple of years compared to when he wasn't on them. He's less clear about Marion Jones because exactly when she was on the steroids, I'm not clear about. So I think you have to be careful to be precise and certainly to accuse people who've got fast times because they're on steroids. But I think with Ben Johnson, it's likely that he got faster because of the power. That was the kind of athlete he was, you know. I think it was almost certainly the case.
So, Chris, you also have a chapter on gene doping. And an interesting statement you make in the book, at the start of the book, is that really all high-performance athletes are genetic anomalies, and which makes reading it made perfect sense. That I could run 100-meter sprints all day for a year, and I'm never going to run under 10 seconds. So, but is it possible in some way to create those genetic anomalies?
I think I would have said to create it, no, initially, when I first started the book. There are a few examples of creations in some situations where it might be possible. So I think with someone like Usain Bolt, it's some horrible combination of things, and we just don't know enough about it to even think how you would create it. Mm-hmm. We don't know enough. We can look at the biomechanics of Bolt and say he takes fewer paces to get where he's going. He's very unusual because he's tall, got power, and could coordinate. And it's very difficult to find anyone who looks like Usain Bolt. So I was looking in the book thinking, well, what other sport would there be somebody who was that tall, 6'5", 6'6", that powerful? And I thought there must be an American footballer who was like that. Because if you're a wide receiver, you've got to be strong and powerful, particularly fast. And it's not true. There are very few American footballers who are anywhere near as tall as Bolt, and they're certainly not as fast. So he's a bit of an anomaly, but it's probably a combination of things we don't know about. So in that sense, we don't know about the genetic Boltness of Bolt, but almost certainly it's in his genes as well as all his training. But when it comes to certain effects, we do know more, and we probably can potentially alter it genetically. And the example I would give that's most famous relates to this blood doping we talked about, the idea about having more oxygen in your blood, and particularly this molecule EPO. There was a Finnish cross-country skier called Eero Mäntyranta, who won many gold medals, one of the most famous in the Winter Olympians there was in Finland. And he had a high red blood cell count. So you might think he was with lots of red blood cells, he'd been doping. It turned out he had a modified, what's called a receptor for EPO. So even though he had the same amount of EPO in his body naturally as everyone else, he was completely overactive in his body's response to that EPO. So he made more red blood cells. And he had that for his whole life. And he lived with it, appeared to be okay. So he was a single gene modification that made him better at sport. So that's, if you like, the idea that the gene dopers, people have cling on to, that maybe there's a magic single gene. Because you can't possibly change 20 or 30 genes in somebody if you want to create something. So what the gene dopers want to do is find a single one that makes a difference. And I think with endurance sport, it's possible. I mean, with power sports, there is one gene that is of interest, and that's the myostatin gene, which, if you look at, I mean, the best example is, if you've ever seen these, they're called Belgian double-muscled cows. You look at a bull from that breed, and they're just huge. They're double-muscled. They look massively strong and muscled. That's a single defect that removes a gene called myostatin. And myostatin, that's the myo's muscle, Greek, statin means stop. It stops muscle growth you remove that gene and you get this very enhanced muscle growth. So again, the idea is maybe you could design somebody without that. Now, we do know there are people walking around who don't have that gene. What we don't know is how many of them are powerful athletes and weightlifters. So because we don't gene test people.
At the end of the book, you turn to questions of why doping is illegal, and you ask whether it should be illegal. And in that chapter, you take on two of the main arguments for banning doping. One, that doping is unsafe for the health of athletes, and two, that doping provides an unfair advantage. So can you talk about the conclusions you made in that chapter to those two questions?
Yeah, I mean, I always try and present the questions and say, look, let's look at the science, make our discussion on the basis of understanding science. I mean, understand, has this molecule got a risk? Understand, does it improve performance? Base it on the science and be sensible. So, and then it's just everybody in the street can make that decision. So one of the reasons to write the book was to say, okay, we're going to be talking about drugs in sport. Let's understand the science. So I have my own personal views, which I will give you because I'm sure you're interested, but read the book and come to your own views. That's really what I'm saying. What my own personal views are, you're asking in terms of safety and in terms of the performance enhancing. I mean, I think I do have concerns about the safety, and it's largely because of the same thing any parent would have about once these things become acceptable, they'll get used by kids, and then there'll be pressure put on kids to use them. And I think that's similar to what happened in East Germany, where there was pressure put on kids and adults to take drugs. I think they're potentially unsafe. And I think that's problematic, and I'd rather there was at least the pretense that we're trying to stop it. So I think my personal view would be that if you think it's people who want to legalize drugs, make them unban, are not really aware of what Pandora's box they're opening, because biochemists can think of lots of weird things. And we've talked about some of them. And I think just saying, let's have a level playing field, I think there are serious things that would be problematic. I think anabolic steroids in females, it's very difficult to see how you would think that, it's unnatural, but that's a sort of sensible route to go down. I mean, I was just interviewed this afternoon by a female bodybuilder who doesn't go in the top competitions because there's no way she can compete in those, competes naturally on the basis that, she doesn't want to have the side effects from there. And I think that seems to me sensible, and I don't think you'd want to have those sorts of competitions. So my personal view is that there are some areas where the health problems are so obvious that really we should hold the line there. I'm much less concerned about some areas where the health risks are very minor and the performance benefits are less strong, things like the sort of cough mixtures and cold remedies that have stimulants in them and people sometimes test positive for. They're called things like pseudoephedrine, phenyl, which is banned for, and really not that bad for you and probably not that performance enhancing. But actually, I think the sporting bodies and the anti-doping agents are sort of coming on board with that now, along with recreational drugs, which are banned in sport because they're bad for the image of sport rather than their performance enhancing. And those bands are now quite short, and they've coming along with those lines. So I think it's sort of about right, is my view, where we stand. But, it's not, in some ways, not a dissimilar debate to drugs in society. You can imagine in a different place, and that's perfectly feasible if society wants that. So what I always want to say is that, okay, if you get to that place, think about it carefully, because you may not really want to be there. So don't think it's, and sometimes people who think that haven't thought it through, haven't thought about the science through and the implications. And I think that's all my book is about, really, trying to enable people to make informed decisions about drugs in sport.
Well, we're almost out of time, Chris, and we do need to talk about Lance Armstrong.
We can talk about him now.
Yeah. So couldn't
do that before. He's hardly in the book.
He is. He's in the book twice, and you mentioned him only in passing. And I like the line that you had on your blog, though, after the news broke of Lance Armstrong back in August, where you wrote, "Now I am finally free to write about Lance Armstrong, with little chance of initiating a lawsuit." So I'll ask you. I'll phrase it this way: when the second edition of your book comes out, how will you put, or is it necessary to put, Lance Armstrong into the book?
Oh, clearly he'll be in the book, because in terms of the whole Tour de France issue is a, you know, one of the paradigm issues of doping in sport, as has been the East Germans. So if you want to look at the situations where doping is systematic and therefore I can, really problematic, because, then is real unfairness rather than the odd person you want to catch. It's that organised doping and organised crime versus the odd criminal. Then, the East German system clearly was one. I think arguably the concern with Balco and what they were trying to do was, although not quite the same scale, was a concern in the US. And then the Tour de France, where it was clear that a number of teams, if not the majority, were systematically doping. Now, that's okay if that's all above board, and you say, that's all right, let's do it, let's control it. I have no problem with that if that's what the rules are. But the rules aren't that way, and you then end up being kicking people off your team, which was what was happening, because they were not doping or talking about it. Then I think that's problematic. So I think it makes it easier to talk about that when you can talk about the person who won 7 Tour de France in a row and has been implicated in it. So in that sense, yes, he'd be in the story. I mean, what's intriguing to me, which I do mention in my blog, is that it's clear that if Lance Armstrong was not doping, he still says he was not doping. If Lance Armstrong was not doping, then you look at all the people he beat were, accused of doping, and some of them found guilty of doping. So he was the only one, not doing it at the time, if that story is true, if we believe him. So, either he was just superhuman and didn't need to dope, well, he was doping better than all the others as well, which is why I sort of mentioned in my blog a bit. And I think that's an interesting question when you look at some of the fine details of the history of this. He might well have been doping better than other people were doping. And I think that's a separate discussion. We haven't finished the story about Lance Armstrong and cycling that period. It's not ended. I mean, some bits I can't talk about because there's obviously an ongoing discussion between USADA, the US Anti-Doping Agency, and UCI, which is the Union Cyclist International, and about the doping tests that were done in that period. So there's still an ongoing debate. The cycling hasn't quite cleared out its stables yet. But certainly, I think the Lance Armstrong story has helped. And interestingly, I was, I think when I wrote that blog, I thought when Lance Armstrong decided not to defend the case anymore, that people would stick with the settled views, the public would come to the sort of settled views that I guess he hoped for, that some people are against him, some people are for him, let's just leave it like that, it'll sweep under the table. But I think what's happened, at least in Europe, is that the public, informed by the journalists who had all of their stories ready to go to print, have pretty much come to the settled view that he was guilty. And I think Tyler Hamilton's book coming out now, I think, will increase that view. So when I thought it would be a settled sort of, it might sweep it under the table, I think what it's done, at least in our side of the pond, has been very clear. It's still, some of the cyclists don't want to talk about it, but in terms of the public now, the concept of Lance Armstrong as being a clean athlete, unfairly accused, has sort of gone, in as much as they're concerned about it at all. So I think that's an interesting development. I always say when I'm talking about him, he has always said he didn't dope. So I think you all should at least say that, even if someone has been found guilty. So for legal reasons, I do always tend to say that. But I think that's true. So I think his reputation on our side of the pond has pretty much gone, except that at the time, as I said, everyone else was pretty much doping then, and he was still the best. Mm-hmm. He beat them, day in, day out. Tour in, tour out. So, his story is still pretty amazing, but I think it's still not definitive until Lance tells his story, which I don't think he's going to. So I think that's it. So I don't think we'll ever know. And which I, in some ways, there's a matter. Well, I think it'd be good for cycling to clean itself up and finally put that behind it. And I think it's close to that. I think hopefully the next year that will get solved. Say the last two Tour de Frances have been, most would say, and I think I would completely agree, a lot cleaner than in previous years. So that's good, because it's more honest. Even if what do you think about doping, at least it's clear what's going on, and there are no rules being broken or fewer, which I think is good.
You do raise a question at the end of the book, and this is interesting. And I don't know how to phrase it in terms of a question, but in looking at doping, and in particular genetic doping and the possibilities for that, we're really looking at the limits of what humans are able to do in terms of athletic performance, correct? And you do cite some research in which we see we're in athletics, in track, we're reaching the limit of what is humanly possible. And so is it possible then, do we see doping as a means of extending that or of pushing that boundary?
Yeah, I think that feeds back to the first chapter where I talked about, you know, about what have we evolved to be? Where are we optimized already? Which events? And I suspect we've evolved to be good at very long distances, not too fast, which is, there's very few sports that are like that. So there probably is, if you like, a gap for us to get better by genes and by training. Whether doping gets you beyond that, I'm not sure. I think if you were able to genetically engineer a person precisely, there must be a gap you can get to. But we're so far away from being able to do that. And I think we'll see those changes. You know, if we see that, we'll see changes in other walks of life before then, in terms of creating superhumans. Because you've got to do it in the germline, I think, to really do these big effects, which we do in animals, because in animals we can see very large effects by manipulating genes. But you do it, you know, in the embryo. And we ain't going to be doing that at that level in humans, certainly not with numbers of genes anytime soon. I think we do it in very specialized cases, but it's not going to be common. So I think in that sense, I think it's theoretically possible, but I think it must be possible to go faster. But there are various calculations about what is the fastest time you could possibly do. And it's interesting, the men's 100 meters is one where people do say there's space to move on the extrapolation to one of the few events. So, which is really why Bolt coming out there is not as surprising as you might think. So they're talking possibly about 9.4, 9.3, which is a bit of a way to go still in those events. I think in terms of women's events, if we go back to that, there's clearly almost two levels of activity for women's events. Mm-hmm. So that is true. So I would say in men's events, it's always a bit more complicated. Probably there's a maximum amount of blood doping you can do for the aerobic events. Women's events with steroids, I think you are almost doing two different sports. So I think that's true. And I think, therefore, that's a different thing, because you're turning a woman into partly a man because you're giving them the men's powers. And we have said, we know that those genes make a difference. The one genetic difference we know is strong is male and female. So we know that Y chromosome has a massive effect on sports performance. So it's clearly that's there. So as long as we have this differentiation between men and women, there's a big, what we call as scientists, dynamic range in the female performance, which you can access. Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing is the comparison with horse racing, which I use in the book, where we've got a limited stock. Mm-hmm. We've done it with not very many horses, and it's not clear how much faster we can get horses to go. Well, I think that's an interesting question when you do the calculations. It's not been massively faster in the last 30, 40 years, horses. So it ought to be getting better because of better training and stuff, but it's not massively, whereas compared to athletes, it is true. But we're looking at a much bigger genetic stock with athletes, you know, the whole 4 billion population, and you know, from going in the dim past, whereas the horses, we know, much, much smaller and more areas. So I think we haven't quite got there with athletes yet.
So, Chris, you're doing your research in artificial blood, and you have this book out. You're going to be sticking in the field of blood research, or do you have plans for the second edition of this book? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm supposed to be writing a book on blood, actually. So, blood—a very short introduction, so a general thing on blood rather than the sports doping. That's a book I'm writing on. The research I do is partly on artificial blood, and you know, there's a patent out there. If you've got a few million pounds, put it my way. We can take it to the next level. But in terms of the other research, I also work in a sort of, partly because I mentioned in sport, but also in medicine. This to basically my users trying to shine light to look at how the body works, and in particular to look at hemoglobin, which is this red molecule I talked about that carries oxygen around the body. We can shine light on the body and look at the hemoglobin inside the muscle for athletes or inside the brain for injured patients. And that's really another major research area I've got, trying to develop new tools for looking at the body non-invasively. So not taking a blood sample, just looking directly and seeing how the oxygen is being used. You know, the dream is like sort of the Star Trek, you know, I'm like you say, a 40-year-old academic, looking at what Dr. McCoy did, bones, when he waved a little recorder around the body and saw everything that was going wrong. So we can do that a little bit with light, with lasers, but it's not where we want to be yet. So the dream of doing that and looking at the oxygen without touching the body and developing tools for that is another interest I've got, and that's both in sport and in medicine. So all based on blood, but not necessarily taking the red stuff out and looking at it, trying to look at it inside the body. That's really where my interests lie.
You've been listening to an interview with Chris Cooper about his book, Run, Swim, Throw, Cheat, The Science Behind Drugs and Sport, published in 2012 by Oxford University Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from science fiction to philosophy. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter or friend us on Facebook. You can give us your feedback, offer suggestions, and find links to thoughtful sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.